Hello there, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Sports Pro podcast. My name is George Breer. I'm head of events content here at Sports Pro. And as ever, I'm delighted to be joined by Sports Pro's off-platform editor, Mr. Tom Bassam. New title, but the same old Tom. It's good to be back in the seat with you. It's been a few weeks.
Yeah, George, we've bumped you out for a few episodes and you've come back and my new title is now official. I'm delighted to off-platform with you.
Great to be off-platforming with you. Now, before we get into the stories for today and to introduce our special guest that we have, I have to ask you, did you watch any of the sporting bonanza over the weekend? And are you, like me, dressed in black for mourning?
Don't know what you're talking about.
The Rugby World Cup, the Cricket World Cup, the football?
I'll be honest, I was otherwise preoccupied. So sporting bonanza that it was, I was not tuned in. Like the Rugby World Cup was something that happened on my phone. The Cricket World Cup was something I wasn't aware of.
You're not helping my mourning here, Tom.
Well, it helps with mourning. Maybe just don't ignore it.
And I'm in denial. That's the next stage.
Like I pre-denied. Much like Roman in Succession, I pre-grieved the defeats. Avid viewers of that show, you'll get that reference. George, I don't know if you've made it to season four yet.
Not season four. No, I'm near the end of season one. I've just got up to one of them stag do. So it's good so far.
Yeah.
Anyway, we won't bore you with that anymore. And instead, I'm delighted to say we are joined by Gabriel Germán Higinio Hoyos today, one of the analysts here at Sports Pro. Gabs, welcome to the Sports Pro podcast. First of all, did I get your name right?
You did a pretty good attempt, but might need a little bit of refining here and there.
My Spanish skills are not quite what they were back in the day. But it's great to have you on the show. You've been responsible with putting together some of SportsPro's commercial guides that are released across SportsPro Plus over the past few months. And most recently, that's been a project that's quite close to your heart.
Yes, the NBA commercial guide upcoming in the next week, I believe. And diving into the specifics and the analytics, I worked extensively across a lot of the data that we've pushed out on there.
Two of your big loves combined, the NBA and data analysis.
Exactly. I am more than happy to work on that.
Yeah, it's not a coincidence that we got Gabs in for the NBA episode. He's a bit of a basketball nut. Although more of a EuroLeague fan than an NBA fan, is that right, saying?
Yeah, so I started playing basketball when I was 18, so quite a late bloomer to it, but have fallen in love with the sport. And EuroLeague is mainly where I watch the majority of my content, given the hours that I can actually watch it, with the NBA being on so late. But and I also did a degree with sports business with EuroLeague as well. So yeah, as you can see, there's a bit of a passion going on there, but more than happy to talk about the NBA. I think it's really exciting what they're doing in the upcoming season, although some challenges ahead.
I remember going to a London Lions game with you at the, I think it's the Copper Box Arena, and it was basically being an educational rapture, learning all the details of a game in about an hour. So I was very, very grateful to you for that. Now the NBA commercial guide just dropped across the Sports Pro Plus platform. Gabs, can you give me a bit of a overview as to what the commercial guides are, what sort of content people can find in them, and in particular, some of the highlights for this year's NBA's version?
Well, with regards to the commercial guides, we try to fit in as much information commercially about the leagues that we are showcasing through the commercial guides. And this involves highlighting the broadcasters, both international and national, looking at the deals and the details within them, when they started, when they expired, etc. Also looking at the sponsors, both major sponsors, minor sponsors across both the league, and looking more granularly into the teams themselves to understand what their sponsorship portfolio is like and how they're performing as well in terms of social valuations, in terms of how the NBA, for example, is performing consumer-wise across different demographics and how, you know, it compares to other leagues and across other teams.
Yeah, so the commercial guides are something that Sports Pro has done for a while, but what we've done recently is really supercharge them and take them to the next level, as they're like ram-packed with data, and we've been rolling them out for a few different properties over the last few months. We talked recently about the NHL guides, done them for the NFL, done them for the Premier League, and each year they grow and expand as we gather more data on each of those leagues. And the new NBA one is no different. It's very complete, and you can go into it and select, for example, each team that you want to kind of explore, look at all the league sponsors, and as Gab said, like the media rights holders and all of that kind of stuff. When they roll round from the editorial team, it's a project that looms large on the calendar.
Labour of love.
Yeah, fair to say they are a labour of love. And they continuously update as well. So if a new deal is signed, that gets added to the guide for that season, etc.
Well, they may be a labour of love, but they do come with legions and legions of fans, myself being one of them. And I do find them a hugely valuable resource at that one destination, that one-stop shop to basically understand the entire commercial ecosystem of a certain property. You know me as a big cricket fan. The IPL commercial guide is regular nighttime reading just to lull me to sleep, looking at the broadcast landscape and its ever-changing nature.
Is lull you to sleep where we want to be going with these? I don't know. But I mean, at least you're reading them late at night, George.
So it's a feature of my dreams. I just dream of the changing commercial landscape and what that means for the cricketing ecosystem. But we'll save that for a 3-hour podcast special down the line, which you can look forward to. Anyway, as Tom rolls his eyes, I thought I'd dive into a couple of the areas that I found particularly interesting looking at this year's guide. The first is looking at the broadcast figures that we've seen over the past few decades and the trend that we're seeing in terms of overall viewership when it comes to the NBA, both at home and internationally. Gabs, what were your sort of main thoughts in terms of what we've learned this year?
Well, it's kind of interesting when you look at the data in terms of average yearly viewership at the domestic audience within the US. One thing that is kind of clear to me is that viewership has kind of been stagnating post Jordan's retirement. When you look at the years that Jordan was active and playing, those were some of the highest broadcast numbers years. So the average yearly viewership data in, for example, 1995 to 1996 hit 2.99 million. Whereas you look closer today, post-COVID, you know, which has its own challenges in itself in recovering that viewership, the 2022 to 2023 season got an average of 1.59 million viewers, which is quite a stark difference. I think there's been a couple of reasons for that. Most notably, after Jordan's retirement, a lot of the TV deals were very cable heavy, which meant that a lot of free-to-air access to the NBA was kind of lost for a significant portion of games, which affected, obviously, viewership. Going even further, there was a slight rejuvenation when LeBron James moved to the Miami Heat, and this led to a rise in viewership. But ultimately, once that kind of hype, I guess, died down, the viewership kind of returned back to normal. So 2013, 2014, towards the end of his stint at the Miami Heat, hitting 1.95 million. That's a similar trend you see through the years following that in the mid-2010s and the kind of recent downturn with regards to COVID. The viewership figures rarely exceeded 1.9 million on average, which kind of shows that I think there's a bit of a problem there, I think, that the NBA has to navigate. And what they're doing by including the in-season tournament, by including the play-in games as well, can address some of those. But ultimately, it's 82 games in a season per team. There's only so much attention you can really expect from a sports fan in terms of watching every single game, especially when they may not necessarily matter in the long haul of the season. Hence, obviously, the play-in tournament and the in-season tournament that they're introducing newly this year.
Tom, there's obviously a lot of factors that go into the shifting viewer numbers, but one correlation that you can't really deny is the impact that big personalities has on viewership in the league. Gab's just talked a little bit about Michael Jordan's impact in the sort of the late 90s, seeing, you know, average viewership approaching the sort of 3 million mark around the late 90s point. That again sort of dips to about 1.5 to 1.8 in the sort of early noughties. And then the 2010 to 2012 is back towards the 2.5 million. And as Gab says, that coincides with LeBron James at Miami. There are problems there, but how contingent do you think the league is on having those big marketable personalities and those sort of individuals that can bring attention to the league more so than other sports?
I think so. It's kind of the league's blessing and its curse at the same time. Like, it relies on personalities. So when you've got big personalities, the league will generally do better. I actually think that there's a kind of a issue in the league at the moment in that there's almost too many big personalities. There's probably actually almost to the point where there's not enough NBA teams. That might bring viewership into the NBA finals where you see these players come together. But like, as Gab said, like the sort of 82 game format of the season, I think is the bigger issue for the NBA. And there's been talk around, should they cut the number of games? Should they introduce different formats? And like, I think those are better probably designed to address the issue than trying to worry about something that you can't really control, which is like the flow of talent and who it is you've currently got in the league. I think the lesson of the last 10 years is that that's refreshed itself quite regularly. After LeBron James, you've seen Steph Curry really rise up in prominence. You've seen Kevin Durant be a really big name draw for a couple of years. You've had the same thing with the likes of like Luka Doncic coming to the league from Europe in the last couple of years. And now you've got another one with Victor Wembanyama going to the San Antonio Spurs. When it comes to the league and how it positions itself, the star factor is obviously a big thing, but like actually it's, I think the way that they're thinking about it is format and how do we address that? And that's probably a nice place to start that conversation, actually.
So on that note, what is being introduced this year to sort of try and kickstart that interest again, or not kickstart that, that's probably a slightly too strong, but to reignite and try to push towards the levels of interest that have been seen in previous years?
So the last couple of years, we've had a play-in tournament for the playoffs. So basically the last spot in the playoffs, so the eighth place in the playoffs, is decided by a play-in tournament, like a mini bracket to get to that last playoff spot. So the postseason before the postseason, which I think the league would say it has proved successful. There's been big audiences for that, especially as we've sort of touched on, like when you've had big name players in that. So we've had the Warriors playing in the play-in games, which is fantastic for the NBA when it comes to driving viewership. This year, we've got a mid-season tournament, which is essentially, like, for us Europeans, we'd be like, oh, right, yeah, the FA Cup. It's that. It's another competition with a different trophy, which rewards different things, maybe even like slightly reward a different kind of basketball and kind of basketball that people are slightly more interested in watching, because it does mean that Jeopardy is on every single game. So the potential is there for increased viewership. It's going to be whether or not it captures the players' like motivation. I think fans can tell. People don't watch the All-Star game because they want to watch competitive basketball. They watch it for all the other stuff. And they can very much tell that these guys aren't putting in the effort. Whereas if you get this mid-season tournament and all of the players putting in their max effort because it's worth it, then it should drive the sort of the interest that I think the NBA wants it to.
Gabs, Tom made the comparison to the FA Cup here in the UK. I think a lot of people would share some concerns at what Tom said of the top players putting in the max effort when you look at other domestic in-season cups that we see around the world. That typically, you know, with more and more packed schedules than ever, players do seem to deprioritize those forms of tournament. Is that a concern that you see for the NBA this year?
Absolutely. I think it's been an ongoing concern even before the announcement of the in-season tournament, with a lot of big name stars obviously affected by load management, choosing to sit games out, or teams telling them to sit games out, teams that they think they can easily beat or games that they don't think matter. What I'm concerned with specifically around the tournament is how the team views it, rather than necessarily than the players, because players understand they want to put on a show for the fans because the fans are, you know, who drives the revenue and who they really ultimately care about. But teams will look at this tournament and will think, so what? What am I benefiting from this? What am I getting from this? Obviously, with the NBA championship, you get the increased coverage on TV, you get increased social coverage, you get the NBA prize money. But when you look at this in-season tournament, the NBA has to think of incentives it can provide to make teams tell their players to compete best as they can.
To prioritize it, right?
Exactly, which currently I don't see them really being able to do, because obviously the NBA championship is what everyone wants, even players. It's the holy grail of basketball to win one of those. Is the in-season tournament going to be similar? I really don't think so, unless, as I said, they can structure it in a way that provides incentives to both the teams and to the players themselves.
And what about to the fans in there? And how can you incentivize it so that there's engagement from all parties? And what would you want the NBA to be saying to teams as a, you know, the carrot and also the stick, I guess, to make sure that that tournament is taken as a priority and treated as a priority?
Well, ultimately, as you say, the fans want the best players going at each other 100% and seeing who comes out on top. With regards to the NBA offering the carrot, I think there is potentially scope for more, I suppose, prize money, a greater share of revenue potentially to the winners, draft picks potentially. But then again, you may come into a discussion where top teams may not necessarily want that draft pick because it doesn't suit their current timeline of winning. A draft pick doesn't help them win a championship that year. Yeah. So why are they going for it? But at the same time, it incentivizes maybe lower ranked teams that are maybe tanking the season to really go for that play-in tournament and really try and get, as you say, those draft picks. It's a difficult one to really navigate. And I think unless the star players from each team are playing, viewership and attendance is going to remain fairly low.
Because I think that's a nuance that I wanted to come on to, Tom, which is, yes, the average viewership across the regular season is a concern for the NBA, particularly its failure to rebound after the COVID years, which to me, paradoxically, seemed to have dropped viewership when you'd think that share of attention was at its lowest mid-pandemic. But actually, the really concerning trend there as well is the finals. And the declining viewership of the finals almost seems to outstrip the rate of the decline of the regular season. How much of that is a concern? And what do you think are some of the factors behind that, Tom?
I think the finals, they should be a concern. Like the COVID year was very, very bad, almost half the year before. But like, I think given the climate, that was kind of almost expected.
So why was that expected? Because that to me seems to be illogical.
The tournament was out of kilter of when it usually is in the season. There were other things going on. I think it might have even crossed with the NFL season, which is always tricky when you're gathering attention in America. Like, I'm not 100% sure on that, but it was definitely much further delayed than they'd want it to be. I think as well, like, the product wasn't there. Like, you're watching a finals where it was basically 13 guys in a gym. They had like big screens and they'd made it as like attractive as they possibly could, but there was no fans there. And like,
that is one thing with the NBA, is having had the fortune of attending once whilst away at Sports Row in New York a couple of years ago, it is an incredible form of entertainment. The sporting element is almost secondary to the intersection with lifestyle, music, fashion. It's just a phenomenal day out, really. You don't even have to focus on what's happening on the gym floor to really enjoy it. Do you think that was a major impact on the quality of the product?
Yeah, I think so. Like, I think that was something that was generally seen pretty globally in terms of those numbers were down for most sports properties during that time. The other mitigating factors, since then, you've had a couple of finals with smaller market teams in, and like that's a major thing. If it had been the Lakers versus the Celtics in the final for the last couple of years, we probably wouldn't be talking about it. It's in quite the same vein. But that's also the nature of the NBA. Like I said earlier, there's more talent, more spread out. There's a lot of factors that go into it. I do think that like it's got parallels with baseball in the same way, is that they so the finals are stretched over 7 games. You're asking for more people's time in a period where people were prepared to give less of it away. That's a problem. Whereas, so like the Super Bowl, they're asking for a day, and like they ask for one Sunday. If it's like 17 Sundays a season, 18 Sundays a season, the NBA is way more demanding. Quite hard to build up like a narrative over 80 odd games. But then you got the playoffs, and then you're asking for a 7-game final series. Where like, sure, like there'll be games where it comes down to that game. If you get down to a game 7, you'd expect really high audiences on that, but you don't get it like as a standard because you could be, I don't know, could be a blowout in 3. It's a kind of almost a victim of the fact that it's got this historical format. That's hard to get over. I don't think also we can talk about the NBA in the same way as the NFL. It's almost like you don't want to measure them by the same metrics because actually they don't really have the same kind of audiences. And whilst it'd be great if it got big ratings, I'm sure it'd be really, really happy. Like it judges itself on other things, and it judges itself on other forms of engagement because of the audiences that it has. And I think like it might be a good time to talk about it. If we look at the audiences, like, and you can see this in the commercial guide, like the age profiles of the fan, it is younger than most of the like other major American sports properties. Therefore, like less likely to have cable, but more likely to be engaging with those things in other places. That engagement in other areas is really what like the NBA probably wants to measure itself on.
Gabs, can you talk us through some of those stats that came out in terms of the audience demographics? Because they are very interesting.
Sure. So this is data collected by Ampere Analysis, who provided this information to the commercial guide. And when looking at the percentage of sports fans who follow the NBA by age and country, and you look at particularly the younger ages, 18 to 24, maybe even 25 to 34 at a stretch, and you look at the percentages in the NBA, 41% of sports fans, according to Ampere's surveys, are actually watching the NBA or engaged in the content that the NBA puts out, both across socials, off platform, and you know, on platform and on TV. But also, it's not just the USA. When you look at a variety of other countries, you see that this engagement is actually quite high. So the next highest in the countries that were surveyed was Brazil, which 40% of 18 to 24-year-olds actually follow the NBA by age and coverage. And this is kind of huge, for example, because when Ampere surveyed the same kind of fans and countries in the NFL, the next highest in this age bracket was Brazil as well. Only 14% of fans actually followed the NFL actively across a variety of platforms. And I think that speaks somewhat to the NBA's strategy around that, but also how global the game is.
I think it ranks 5th overall, right, as a sports property and sort of the highest ranking sports property outside of soccer internationally for fans in that sort of very coveted demographic of 18 to 34. And as you say, that quite significantly outstrips other major properties like the NFL in the US. So it's a pretty compelling proposition for advertisers, for broadcasters, and for brands wanting to be involved in the sport, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like if you ask a brand generally, who do you want to market your products at? They'll be like that age group, or like that demographic. And that's where the NBA sits in its sweet spot. That's what it has in its favor. And it's done a really good job of getting itself into the platforms where that matters. And its highlights are really popular on TikTok. It's really popular on Instagram, but it works with third parties to push that outside of its own operated platforms as well. It's really happy for other people to take its content and run with it, because that's how it knows it's going to reach the people that it wants to. And it helps as well that, like, its stars are appealing to those age groups. You mentioned it. There's that cultural crossover. People look at, like, the outfits that NBA stars turn up to games in. They engage with them on their own social channels. That like, you can see them on the court in the way that you can't see a major NFL star when they're on the field. Like, it just isn't quite the same level of engagement. You get it a bit with baseball, but, like, baseball's got a much older demographic just because of the nature of the game, whereas basketball is all action, fast-paced, and it ticks a lot of boxes in that regard.
Or at the moment, you get it quite a lot with Travis Kelce and the Taylor Swift army of fans. But we can come on to that another time. I actually, a couple of weeks ago, I watched the film Hustle on Netflix. I don't know if you've seen it, with Adam Sandler, based around, you mentioned the Celtics earlier. But I did think during that film that there's probably no other sport around the globe that could attract a completely A-list cast of NBA stars, former, current, present, future, and just the sort of the wraparound cast. It really was a showcase of the tournament. I think LeBron James is one of the exec producers, but it does kind of speak to its lifestyle appeal, right? That sits way outside of just the sporting remit.
Well, I think one of the major things to understand about basketball in the US is it's more of a culture. It's less so a game in isolation from everything else that's going on around it. The NBA has incredible weight in terms of social justice, in terms of how it attracts celebrities and how celebrities interact with the stars in the NBA. For example, I think a couple of days ago, Victor Wembanyama, who's first round pick of this year's draft, recently met Drake, one of the biggest stars in music, probably in the history of music. And also, Drake is an avid NBA fan. But speaking on how even that occurs, I don't think you really see that anywhere else in any other sports property. And it's because of just how integrated into the culture basketball is in the US, especially across many of its celebrities and stars, and just how much the NBA also leverages that, inviting them to games, bringing them to the NBA finals, bringing them to regular season games and having them interact with players and teams and making that output visible across all the platforms that it has.
Yeah, I guess as well, you mentioned Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift. That happens so regularly in the NBA that it's almost not news. I'm sure it would be news if Taylor Swift turned up.
That is a bold claim, Tom.
And started dating like one of the biggest stars in the league. But in the NFL, that feels a lot less common than it does in the NBA, where, like, as you said, like, Drake is, I think he's almost actively employed by the Raptors as an ambassador to a certain degree. That's that closeness in the two cultures. Before we go on to talking about Victor Wembanyama and some of this other stuff, though, we probably do need to do some nitty-gritty business chat, because the other thing I think that, like, we probably deserves discussion and is looming large on the horizon from the NBA and all of this talk about ratings is the media rights deals, right? These are wrapping up fairly soon. I think the exclusivity windows for the current broadcasters begins in March 2024. The reason why those viewership numbers matter, and perhaps why people are paying attention to them now more than ever, is because we're heading into those talks.
Yeah, I think we sort of almost cover the two sides of the coin, right? Which is, yes, there have been some challenges in terms of viewership, but the NBA remains a very powerful media property and second most valuable in the US. And it's currently, I think it's $2.5 billion per season, the deal is worth. It's looking to more than double that per season as part of the new rights deal. And that kind of comes on the back of increases from other major sports properties in the US. Just looking through here, I think the MLB grew theirs by 17%, the NHL more than 50%, the NFL also more than 50%. Gabs, what's your sort of evaluation there? Do you think that's a realistic target for the NBA to be aiming for?
I think it's ambitious, but certainly doable. I think, as we kind of touched on previously, when you look at the demographic of who watches the NBA, even though viewership figures on linear broadcast may be slightly stagnant, the engagement it has from younger audiences almost kind of makes up for that in terms of its value and what it brings to the table in terms of media rights. I think they have to be very careful with this media rights deal. I think when you look at, for example, what the MLS has done, having exclusive worldwide provider being Apple on Apple TV and the success that's had, you could look at that as kind of a blueprint that could maybe work. But it's whether seeing who has the appetite to pay that much for maybe sole exclusivity, or whether that would generate them the most amount of revenue. I think they also have to be careful about hiding itself behind a paywall too much. I think one of the major, you know, benefits the NBA has is how many games are shown regionally as well, to free-to-air, to audiences that may not especially have that access to watching nationally televised games or anything behind a paywall. And especially with the NBA League Pass, which is making it more accessible worldwide, not just in the US, there's definitely scope there, I think.
Tonk, that's probably the main sort of debate in Adam Silver's intro, right? Which is, do you go down the smaller partners, the security that that brings, the sort of the distribution and the reach that that can bring, particularly when we're talking about the impact that can have with advertisers, with, you know, lifestyle brands looking to be involved, or, you know, with reports that some of the national broadcast partners like ESPN and Warner Brothers Discovery looking to take smaller packages this year. And I know we ran a piece on the site this week that Amazon might be looking at replicating its Thursday night package that it has with the NFL into the NBA. And given the audience demographic and the streaming weighting towards that demographic, it could be a very exciting time for the NBA to capitalize on that increased competition, a higher number of partners and a higher raw figure.
Yeah, I think there will be another partner brought in, whether it's Amazon, whether it's someone else. I think that's likely to happen. I think as well that they're probably likely to see the current broadcasters keep their packages and, as you said, probably make them smaller. So like ESPN, Disney, ABC, there'll be a mix of that, maybe slightly less games, because that's kind of similar to what Disney did with the NHL. Obviously, Warner Brothers Discovery has recently relaunched its Max product. They started streaming their NBA games on that. It's a really popular show, just their general NBA broadcasts, the Turner stuff. Although there was quotes from David Zaslav a couple of years ago talking about how Warner Brothers maybe didn't need the NBA. I think he's since walked that back a little bit. So yeah, I like the way it looks like it's trending is towards certainly those two broadcasters keeping their package, and then one, maybe two, maybe being carved out. So you end up a bit more like the NFL, where you have like a bunch of national broadcasters all broadcasting slightly different things and products that they get to kind of market individually and market in their own way. Wouldn't be surprised if there was one or two streaming platforms that came into that. So yeah, Amazon being one, the other potentially being Peacock on NBC. They'd have the option then of using their commercial linear channels, which still get really big reach, but also having a place to put games, because frankly, there's a lot of, like, as we've discussed, there's a lot of NBA games. So it's about finding somewhere to house those that's useful and that they can sell, but also being able to offer the NBA that reach. And I think what Amazon's done with the NFL is to show that we might be new, we might be a different kind of broadcaster, but we can actually still provide you with at least some of the reach that you're getting from the main commercial network. So I think that is where that confidence from the NBA comes from. That's why we're seeing these reports around, what is it, like 75, 76 billion over the course of their rights deals. We should mention these are long rights deals, so that big number feels bigger. It's just spread out over a lot of seasons. But I think it's achievable. I think what they're doing now in terms of adding these extra elements to the season, so that the playing games, the mid-season tournament, they all create different things that a broadcaster might want to buy into. And on the local side, I mean, we've talked a lot about RSNs on this podcast. I don't think we need to go into it too much. The NBA is dealing with some of the same issues that Major League Baseball and the National Hockey League is dealing with as well, in that they've basically got to decide whether or not cable's the way to go, and it looks like it probably won't be. But there's going to be, at least with the NBA, they're well set up in that they've got their League Pass product, which is kind of similar. It combines what we've seen with NFL Sunday Ticket, in that people in local markets can buy all their games if they want to, and it's obviously a streaming product, and then you've got local broadcasters as well. So that it's probably going to be that, what we're seeing is that transition combo of like local, sometimes free-to-air broadcasters plus streaming. I think that's going to be where you're going to get. So that's the local level. Then the national level is probably going to be slightly more broadcasters.
Because I think that's an interesting is not actually the word to use. It's quite a complex ecosystem, the US broadcasting one, and the way in which rights are sold, the different packages between a national broadcaster and a local broadcaster. And you talked about that distinction between streaming and cable, at the local level. You know, at the national level, I think it's a fairly well-replicated model across the globe, but it's very different in the US between their local cable model. Can you just talk me through that a little bit? And you said that it's increasingly looking like that won't be the way to go. What are some of the challenges that are associated with cable broadcasting at local levels?
Well, it's that basically people are paying for a lot of things that they don't want and therefore deciding not to pay. The sort of quite expensive rights deals that those local broadcasters will have struck.
And that would just be to broadcast those local games to the state.
Yeah, within that market. And it might not be just a state. It might be a couple of states over, given that these teams often have got a catchment that they're given of a couple of regions. It will be for those local areas and they show all the games. That'll be where your super fan could watch 82 games a year, or at least the ones that aren't picked out on national TV. So upwards of 70 games a year, probably. Maybe slightly less, maybe slightly more. As we've seen in Major League Baseball, as we've seen in the National Hockey League, that model isn't working anymore. I mean, we were at Sports Pro USA earlier this year, and Michael Schneider from Bally Sports was speaking that day, and that day was also when they announced that they would be entering bankruptcy proceedings. So like, yeah, that goes to show where that sector is at and how the economics of that have failed, frankly. And what we're seeing and what we have seen since is a realignment of that local broadcast market. So that's the mixture of deals where teams have been going to local, perhaps like free-to-air broadcasters who offer them the reach but less money, and then also launching their own streaming products. So we've seen that with Vegas Golden Knights being a kind of prime example in the NHL. And I think it's the Phoenix Suns are looking to do something similar in the NBA, or have already launched something similar in the NBA.
Well, there was that sort of bizarre story on first reading of the Phoenix Suns offering to send free satellites to their fans that were looking to watch the games.
Yes, the bunny ears.
Yes. Can you talk me through that story?
People might not have them because they've been unplugging their aerials, but all you have to do is plug an aerial into your TV and it's broadcast like that. There is no cable. It's terrestrial broadcast in the same way that we would get BBC ITV Channel 4 over a terrestrial network in the UK.
I'm not going to press you too much on the nuances of broadcasting technology. Squirming. I can see the whites of your eyes.
Absolutely squirming in this chair.
As I look at more and more of these questions. In the interest of time, Gabs, I want to cover a couple more things before we leave you back to your analysis. But one interesting shift in the NBA compared to maybe some of the other US sports properties is its reach and it sort of all its capture internationally. So around 20% of the overall current media rights valuation comes from international broadcast deals. Do you see that trend continuing, maybe even increasing? And why is that?
There are a few factors behind it. Primarily, the NBA is putting a lot of effort into engaging fans across the world. As you can see, I'll give a few examples. Ever since, obviously, the Dream Team in the Olympics in Barcelona, you have the NBA Europe games that happen fairly regularly in the year. The latest one happened in Madrid, which involved Luka Doncic and the Mavericks. You also have the NBA Africa League that they launched a couple of years back, I believe, to generate talent and to also gain more exposure on the continent. And, you know, their constant and ongoing engagement with China and Asia that they engage in. And specifically because the NBA is becoming such a global sport, that's permeating into the players that are coming in to the league. As I briefly mentioned, Luka Doncic, Giannis Antetokounmpo, you've got various other big name stars that are now European, and a growing percentage are global as well. And what this leads to is a lot more engagement in the home countries of these players who want to follow the storylines, who want to see how well they're performing and are therefore paying for NBA League Pass, paying for extra access to the games that they have, engaging with content on social and other platforms, specifically for these players that come from their countries. And if this trend continues, if the NBA becomes more international, I can only see that growing, despite maybe challenges in, say, time zones and in actually being able to view proper NBA games. Because the NBA does such a good job of showing highlights and more short form clips and videos to its audience, that kind of navigates that challenge as well. And a lot of fans also watch retroactively games. So I can definitely see it increasing as a percentage of the broadcast rights valuation. And I definitely see the international audience growing a lot more in the coming years.
Talk about the European stars being a driving force behind some of that interest. Tom, there's a shiny new one that's been added to the roster for this year. Talk me through Victor Wembanyama and why there's so much hype.
I mean, have you seen him?
Big boy.
He's a big man. And he's not just a big man who is a big man for a big man's sake. I love Shaq, but he was just a big man who happened to be athletic enough to be able to play basketball at the NBA.
Would not say that to his face.
Definitely wouldn't say that to his face. In NBA terms, he's a bit of a unicorn. He's got this insane length. His arms are like longer than my body, I think. But he can also do things on court that much smaller and you'd imagine much more technically gifted players can do. So he can shoot threes, he can dribble. He's kind of a bit of an all-around package. And like, we haven't seen it properly yet in the NBA. He's just been putting up some very impressive highlight clips. But the other thing that he's been doing, and this is why everyone's quite excited about it, is that he's been performing at a pretty high level in France. What the NBA did, which is really, really clever, is that they acquired the broadcast rights to the French league for their League Pass product. And it meant you didn't just stream the NBA, but you could stream like the top French league. I think it's called Pro Basket. Sorry, Gabs, if I got that wrong. But my
pronunciation has been butchered.
That's not what I'm here for. What it gave is like, it gave fans the chance to see him in a platform, an environment that they're very used to, and built up that level of excitement around a player that wasn't even playing in the league yet, but it was like preordained that he was going to be there, preordained that he was going to be a number one overall pick. But everyone has seen what this guy can do. EuroLeague does this to an extent, but like the NBA don't have the rights to the EuroLeague. This was them being like, this is how you can watch this guy. He's going to be the number one pick. Get excited about it. There's other things they do as well. So like social stuff and pre-draft hype, but those are kind of normal. But like that for me was like a really good example of what the NBA does when it comes to growing stars and growing itself as an international property. It's like, here's this star from Europe. Here's how you watch him, American fans. And by bringing him over to the NBA, which is fairly inevitable, you've also brought with you probably a whole new legion of fans from France who they probably had a few years of not having a massive star in the league into the level that Tony Parker, who actually also played for the Spurs, was at in terms of getting that interest. But the fact that you've got that regular pipeline now coming through, like Gaz mentioned Giannis, yeah, Luka Doncic, as I mentioned previously, another big European star, Nikola Jokic currently in the league. Some of the biggest stars now in the NBA are European, and that, a bit like we've seen in the Premier League, turns you into a global product like nothing else.
And they did such a good job of promoting him at the NBA Paris game, right? The sort of the images doing the rounds of Kylian Mbappe being completely dwarfed by Victor Wembanyama. He was such a big feature of the build-up to that game. He really is a bit of a case study in the NBA's ability to do storytelling, to do sort of original content, like non-live content, better than any other property out there.
Mm. And one thing I wanted to speak on this is that it's not actually a new strategy that the NBA is employing here. The method and the platforms are slightly different. When you saw LeBron James coming into the NBA, people were able to watch nationally televised games of his high school games. And this was the hype building around him and the viewership from that early age, especially from younger fans at the time who saw themselves in him being the same age and then, you know, following his dream to become in the NBA. This was mainly broadcast on television, whereas now with Victor Wembanyama, and you see other case studies as well, like the Ball Brothers, Zion Williamson as well, talking towards more US-centric players, where you can follow them from such a young age, from when they're 14, 13. I think my first clip that I saw of LaMelo Ball was him at the age of like 13 or 14, pointing at half court and shooting from half court. And that's what started the kind of hype train around the Ball Brothers and what they could do. This is where I think the NBA is positioned very uniquely in how it works kind of symbiotically with third-party social media, various accounts like House of Highlights. Over time, I think Dan Porter, the CEO, spoke at Sports Pro Live, I believe, in 2021 about their kind of strategy around that. So I believe we may have the video around somewhere on the SP Plus offering that you can watch that.
Hopefully more news to come on that shortly as well.
Oh, fantastic. But when you have these off-platform engagements from third parties, they do a lot of the legwork for the NBA in terms of promoting a lot of the young players that come in. And they build the storylines and the narratives around these players for the NBA in a way that I don't think many other sports properties even do, but much less could even attempt to do. And I think specifically when you look at how they engage younger audiences, it's always short form highlights, it's social media, it's across everything you see, okay, this is the latest dunk Zion Williamson did when he was 14. You know, at the time, you're like, oh my God, that's amazing. He's going to go to the league. The same with Victor Wembanyama when they got the NBA League Pass. He was only really known about 2 years or so before currently when he was drafted, whereas you have other players in the US that are known from the age of 13, 14. And when you build those narratives, they eventually enter the NBA. As Tom said, you kind of bring all those fans with you who want to see how they're doing, who watch what they're doing. And this only kind of works in the NBA because the NBA is the top destination for basketball. I don't think you'll find anywhere else, any other league, for example. You wouldn't see a the Premier League paying for rights to a player in the Spanish league to see how they're performing, because obviously they don't know that that player is going to come to the Premier League. It's very unique in the aspect that they know the best players are going to come to the NBA. So it's not a risk for them to market them from such an early age, even before they even enter the league. It's actually more beneficial. You have more time to build that storytelling. You have more time to build that engagement. Those celebrity engagements, as I said, kind of mentioned, where you could get these players permeating the culture. The NBA feels very comfortable letting third party do it. And also on platform, showing highlights, showcasing what the latest draft picks are going to do, where they're going to be projected, because they know ultimately the talent is going to come to them.
It's a really good point, because when you think in US sports do just have the monopoly on the elite level of their sort of home market sports. And there is that opportunity, as you say, Gabs, that other major sports just don't have, where they know they're the destination and they can act accordingly. They can essentially just build a pipeline of talent, and some may make it, some may not.
Well, also it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy at some point, right? Like you say, we're the top destination. You keep acting like the top destination. You bring in the top players. You don't really give another chance to someone else to become that top player. Like, I kind of feel like actually the Premier League is going in this direction a little bit, almost to the point where now like players come in and get cycled out, and the only way that they're like that's kind of where you're found out and moved on. If you don't get there, you don't quite match like the expectations. You don't deliver. Whereas like, yeah, the NBA has already achieved that place. Like, it's already the Super League of basketball.
Well, on that note, gents, thank you very much for joining me today, as always. For those that have found the conversation interesting and do want to read more and delve into the statistics that we've talked about in more detail and just get a bit more of a sense of the commercial landscape when it comes to the NBA, do head to the Sportswear website, click on the Commercial Guides tab, and you will find the recently released guide there for all Sportswear Plus members. That's included as part of your membership, so do check it out when you can. But I guess the only thing left for me to say is, Tom, thank you for joining me as always. I'll see you next week. And Gabs, great to have you on the Sportswear podcast.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, guys.